Good morning and welcome to Creative Influences Content Conversations. I'm Andrew Dietz, and I have with me Natalie Springfield. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Andrew.
Natalie and I are partners in Creative Influence. Creative Influence is a marketing firm that helps business-to-business companies develop PR and content that builds more and better relationships and revenue. We started Content Conversations as a podcast to help us stay up on what's new and what's next in the kind of all-encompassing realm of content. And we think about content as more, by the way, than just digital content, more than just written digital content that's downloaded in a demand gen campaign. We think of it quite broadly, from in-person events to podcasts like this, to certainly studies and white papers and so on. But we're talking about the broadest context of content. And with that in mind, among the topics we've talked about here on the show have been designing content, the tools available to physically create content. We've talked about distribution and distribution channels and tactics and tools. And we've talked about innovation as well. And I'd say that our conversation today is going to be more on the innovation side and a different angle on content beyond design and distribution, or maybe before that. And that is conceiving and crafting messages in a fact-based way that allows the messaging to be more on target, more on message, and more effective. And to talk about that with us today, we have Will Allred. And Will is the co-founder and COO of Sorter. Will, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have John Wolf. And John is the founder of Inspector 6.
Thank you for having me.
Which I love that name, by the way. But although I will tell you, I always think about, you know, the little label you see in the back of your shirt.
Inspector 12.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Is that what it's?
We're half as good as Inspector 12.
Okay, only half as good. Okay.
But still pretty good.
Well, John, since I automatically put you on the hot seat and my foot in my own mouth, John, I've known you for a number of years, but I understand you had earlier in your career, you were at the Coca-Cola Company, and you've had experience leading marketing for a number of emerging firms, earlier stage companies, as well as large companies like Equifax. And when I met you, you were with Intradiem as a CMO, and I guess you also played a role as chief technology officer. And with a background, an undergrad at Georgia Tech in engineering and an MBA in marketing, it makes sense that you have both right and left parts of the brain balanced. And now at Inspector 6, I'll let you describe what Inspector 6 is, and then we'll turn to Will and we'll do the same.
Yeah, the Inspector 6 started actually in one of those marketing roles, when we had a really well-defined brand and messaging strategy, and we really struggled to execute it. And like all companies, we needed great sales and marketing communications and content to convert prospects into customers, but it was really hard. And it's the most challenging part about it wasn't for us anyway, although this is a challenge for many, determining what topics to write on, because we were in a very targeted area. It was the creation process, and most specifically that iterative process of reviewing the content. It was incredibly labor intensive and subjective and siloed, and we just didn't.
In other words, to say, is this good or is this not good?
Yeah, exactly.
What does good mean?
And what does good mean? And so good almost always came down to opinions and opinions about whether this was going to perform, but they were opinions, and it's really tough to predict performance based on opinions. And even something that should be much more tangible, like is this on brand, is this on message, is this our voice, really came down to opinions. Mm-hmm. And the process didn't scale. And many times I felt like that content needed to come across my desk for me to really ensure that it was going to be our message and our voice. Mm-hmm. And so Inspector Six starts with the question of, well, what if we could use new technologies? And with new technologies come new possibilities. And what if we could use new technologies like machine learning and other forms of AI to standardize and automate much of this process? Not the creation of the content, but the review and the analysis. And then if we can add facts and data and replace those subjective opinions with the facts and data, then we can fill another gap in that we can make the performance of content and communications predictable. Mm.
Excellent. And so just share with us a little bit about where you are with your product and its launch, and how is it being used right now?
Yeah, we've been at it for about a year and a half. We got out to market with a very early version of the product in about 6 months and worked with about a dozen customers, mostly mid-sized customers, to iterate on that product and make it exactly what their marketing teams would need. And then we started a relationship with a very large company, multinational with hundreds of brands. And that gave us a different perspective on what the product needed to be. Solving a very similar problem, the creative process was still hard for them. It was made even more difficult because it was so decentralized. You know, 200 markets around the world. And so now these customers are using it to solve the exact problem that we set out to solve. So that large multinational, for example, they analyze hundreds of websites and social media properties every single day using Inspector 6. And now they're embedding Inspector 6 into the creative process so that when they're developing a Instagram post, for example, Inspector 6 analyzes that content, attaches over 75 brand and messaging measurements to every image and every text block, and then predicts how it's going to perform from an engagement standpoint. And what they envision is eventually you have to reach a certain threshold, a certain index
score. Yeah.
Before you release that post. And so every post is better. And so they're creating better content. They're doing it faster because the review processes is made faster and it'll be more performant.
And did you create this for massive global enterprise? Is that who this product is for?
It's funny. I knew after doing research, so having experienced this problem firsthand, I didn't go straight from that to starting the company. I did research. I talked to about 90 heads of marketing and heads of sales to a lesser extent, and learned that we weren't the only ones having this problem. And it was large companies and small companies. And it's funny, so take one brand at that large multinational in operating in 50 markets. The problem that that brand director is struggling with feels a lot like this same problem that I experienced in running a marketing team of 5 people and working side by side with a sales team of 12 people.
Right.
And so our smaller customers have the exact same problem. Mm-hmm. It's just at a different scale.
Yep.
But to them, it's just as impactful. And they go to market with a lesser brand and a lesser message, and it hinders their growth in the exact same way that it does worldwide for that large multinational.
Yeah, horizontal problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Will, your background is also in marketing, and yep. I know that you went to UNC. So I'm sorry, I went to Duke. So.
Well,
we could still hopefully have a conversation, but
keep it simple.
I'll use one. How do you say syllable in one syllable? I don't know. We'll use very simple words for you, Will. But anyway, I know you worked at Toprite, which was a strategic marketing firm.
Yep.
So you've come to this with a strategist perspective.
Yep.
Although from what you've told me about your business, you know how to implement as well. And your company is Sorter, which enables marketers to provide psychologically resonant brand experiences at scale. through segmentation and your segmentation and recommendation platform. So for those of us who didn't go to Chapel Hill, explain that.
Sorter is making neuromarketing easy for digital teams.
Neuromarketing.
Yes. So you brought up Coke. We're here in Atlanta. Atlanta is the birthplace of neuromarketing, which is the use of biological signals such as brainwave monitors, eye tracking software, EEG, in order to better inform marketers what's actually going on inside someone's head. You know, when we looked at that, it's a tool set that doesn't necessarily scale. I'm not strapping EEGs to everyone's head within the United States. And so a digital marketing team can't scale out those insights like Coca-Cola can for a Super Bowl campaign. I mentioned Atlanta is the birthplace of neuromarketing. There's a firm in Atlanta called Bright House. It's now a BCG subsidiary. They worked with Coca-Cola back in the early 2000s on a taste test with Pepsi. So they did a blind taste test and they did a labeled taste test just to see what was happening inside the brain. And you could actually see the impact of marketing, you know, being in Atlana. You know, so you'd have people blindly taste test both beverages. Pepsi's notably sweeter. And so what you saw in the brain when it was a blind taste test was the reward center in the brain fired much more heavily for a Pepsi. Much to Coca-Cola chagrin.
Yes, which is why they won that taste test way back. Yeah. I'm told I was too young to remember that.
What's interesting though is, credit to the Coca-Cola marketing team, when you put the logo back on, the brain reversed its functioning.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And so it really like gave credibility to what the Coca-Cola marketing team did all these years, right? So that, cursive and the red label. We know there's impact to be had here, but how do we scale it up for a digital marketer? And so instead of thinking about it from the brainwave monitors and what's going on a neurological level, let's take a step up and let's look at patterns of thought processes and behaviors, as well as emotional data that we can look at and quantify. And the best resource for that is the psychology department. You look at big five personality traits of how someone thinks, feels, and perceives the world around them. Well, we just view them as patterns of how neurons fire in people's brains, and they tend to be kind of similar, right? And so we use
give us some examples of that?
When you're talking about personality is just different clusters of behaviors, thoughts, and feelings about certain issues and certain things. There's more extroverted people versus more introverted people. There's theories out there about extroversion that extroverted brains are seeking stimulation, whereas introverted brains are not seeking stimulation. Mm-hmm. You talk about agreeableness versus a lack of agreeableness, which is, somebody's propensity for human relationships versus your more colder, skeptical individual. You talk about openness, you're talking about in computer science, you're kind of talking about an explore versus exploit function. How you can think of it as like you've got your favorite pizza place. Well, how often are you going to go back to the same pizza place versus going and exploring new pizza places to see if you can find a new one? And you can start to take digital signals. University researchers out of Cambridge figured this out pretty quickly. You can take these digital signals and you can start to make really accurate estimations of people's personality. Someone who's been helping us with our modeling at Sorter, a doctor named Yo-Yo Wu, she was one of the first researchers to figure out with 300 data points, she could assess someone's personality better than their spouse. And so we're using that same logic.
I could see how that could happen. No, I'm sorry. That's a personal issue. Go ahead.
We're using that same logic to create our segmentations at Sorter. But creating the segmentations, personality exists across these like large scales, and you could have n number of segments. And we ran into this pretty quickly into our customer discovery, which was How do I make that actionable? You're talking about, you know, making all these different segmentations. You know, I'm struggling with my one segmentation over here, you know, soccer mm-hmm. mom Sally, mm. who's my persona. And we're like, that's great. Well, let's use some other, you know, psychology-based correlations that we can draw off of, like communication patterns, decision-making science, and let's cut that down into just four that we know will be resonant. And so we can create, we can help give recommendations around copy, creative, fragment email campaign, like cadencing, that will be more in line with how this person sees the world. There's a term for that called egocentric. Our viewpoint is, you know, we're trying to leverage these different pieces of information that we'll know will be more egocentric when you're trying to target an individual. And scale that out into any sort of digital interface or digital experience design.
So I know this is hard to do with audio, with no visuals, but can you explain to us what this looks like for your customer? What is it? How are they interacting? What is it that they do with yeah. your offering?
Yeah, so what they're doing is they're getting a better understanding of who their customer is. So is this person geared to think towards the big picture? Are they geared to think about the people around them? Or are they geared to think about the data that's supporting that decision? Or are they someone who's more geared towards action? They're a doer, right? And so we can give them content recommendations.
Got it.
When you're reaching out, how active or passive are you in your language? When you're putting together creative, are you going to use brighter, warmer colors, or are you going to use cooler, more saturated color?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are the contents of that image? Are you going to look at the product? Are you going to look at people using the product? How likely are, you know, reviews or, you know, anecdotes of people loving your product? How likely is that to resonate with the individual? These little personality traits that we can find have a big difference as far as those things. We actually ran an email campaign using these segmentations, and we were able to get that 40% lift right out of the gate.
So are you, is the customer giving you their customer data and you're analyzing that to understand the nature of their audience before you make the recommendations? Is it specific
yeah.
to the company? Yeah.
Yeah. So we can analyze first party data, but we understand that first party data is few and far between. We thought about it from like an e-commerce site standpoint. If somebody lands on an e-commerce site, you get that little window for an email address, but everything past that is kind of sparsely populated, especially if you're talking about a smaller mom and pop e-commerce shop where they might not have as much web analytics to go through. So we built a data pipeline where we can take an email address, fill in the blanks, mm-hmm. and make an assessment with a pretty good level of accuracy.
Fill in the blanks by understanding where that person and how that person has behaved elsewhere on the web or on the internet?
That's actually
yeah.
a piece of it.
Yeah.
So we call that sort of our interest data, where you're mm-hmm. aggregating sort of places where that cookie has shown up.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also demographics, there's social data that we can pull in as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, anywhere between 150 and 300 data points is what we're using to make our judgments.
Mm. So what do we call this field that we're talking about? I've seen words like content intelligence. I'm not quite sure how do you describe. So when you're selling a new offering, your buyers always want to figure out how to categorize you in some way. How are they doing that? What are they labeling you? What do you want to be called with Inspector Six and Sorter?
It's a good question.
Yeah, I think for the broader category, content intelligence, I think fits, because when I think about the whole process of content and where it starts at the very beginning with strategy and planning and ideas and choosing topics, that category, and there's lots of great tools that do that, like Market Muse and Bright Edge. And then moving into content creation, and there's a category of auto generation and companies that are auto generating articles and subject lines. And that's a distinctly different category, but I think still kind of fits into this notion of content intelligence. and then what we're doing, which we would call brand and messaging analytics. And by the way, we're still trying to find our descriptor, because when we start off with brand analytics, people think visual identity and logos.
Yeah.
And we're much more, and we're just as much voice. About messaging and voice and predicting results and competitive intelligence. So we're still kind of trying to find that. Then all the way to analyzing how your content performs, and then cycling back to that strategy step and creating that closed loop. And that category is something different. But I think rolling them up under something that's in general, this kind of broader movement, more than a category, it's a collection of categories, this movement of content intelligence and becoming more methodical and disciplined and data driven about content marketing. I think content intelligence is a pretty good descriptor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of hard to name the baby, right?
Yeah.
I think about what we want to become and like where we're at, and there's so many different places you could categorize that. And it's almost like, you know, are we emotional intelligence enablement, or is it more structured to just audience analytics?
Mm-hmm.
But it's more than that because of the recommendations that we're able to provide. So, content intelligence is a smart way to.
It's an intelligent way to put it.
Yeah.
John, Inspector 6 uses AI as part of it. And Will, yours?
Yeah.
Can we use those machine learning, artificial? What other fancy technologies?
Technically, you could call spell check AI.
Yeah.
Right. It's a computer program that's accomplishing a goal using some known recipe. Right. So I think the you can call a lot of things AI. It's when you start processing a lot of really interesting data that a human being struggled with. That's when like real AI starts to become interesting.
Well, that's where I was going with this, the replacement of human beings. We had a client at one point that was an RPA, robotic process automation company. And of course, they didn't do what you did. They were looking at back end functions and how to automate those things. But their customers were all fearful. There was this emotion of, this is going to do away with our job, this whole department. And okay, maybe we could we've heard about that with accounting or with something more administrative, but with content creation. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about. Auto-generated content, automated editing. Tell us about that and what you're facing in the market, if anything, with growth. Maybe that's just my own neuroses.
Yeah.
Natalie would agree.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not something that I worry about from an overall employment, kind of a macroeconomic standpoint, and that automation has been going on for a long, long time. And the latest wave of automation driven by the advancements in AI, I think, is getting more press because it's impacting information workers who are working in the media. And so with all the years of automation, and most recently from the late 70s and 80s in information worker automation, and even the non-AI software that's had an incredible impact on information worker productivity, we're still at almost full employment. And that's for a number of reasons. Number one is that if you separate jobs into jobs with infinite demand and jobs with finite demand. So jobs with finite demand, the work comes at you like a contact center. And automation will have a bigger impact on those employment rates and the need for those sorts of workers. But what we've seen over the past 100 plus years of automation is that the workforce adapts, and we don't have floors and floors of typists anymore. They all adapted and became designers and graphic designers and copywriters and COOs and everything else that that workforce can become. The second thing is when you take that other category of work and creative content development bits in this, it's nearly infinite demand. So I'll take software development, for example. Every software company's roadmap is nearly infinite. If I can make software development 10 times more efficient, I'm not going to come into work and have 1/10 the number of software developers. I'm going to be writing better software, I'm going to be writing more software. It's a fundamentally creative job with infinite demand. And I think content creation is the exact same way. If I make content creation 10 times more efficient, I'm going to write more content, I'm going to write better content, I'm going to do more experiments. I'm not going to cut down the size of my creative team. And so so that's kind of how I look at it. I think we're going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. And we have 100 years plus of automation to support that.
It's a supplement, not a replacement. Yeah. Will, what did you say?
With automation, you just see prior jobs start to change and new jobs appear.
That's right.
I think it's, you talk about machine learning, AI, and social networks have sort of given scale to a lot of these conversations. And the problem with a lot of these social networks is the conversations that get to scale much more rapidly are the ones that are a little more emotionally charged. And so they can start to, tweak at people and be like, oh, jobs, the things that people worry about, you can start to take advantage of that. And a system that's designed to sort of extrapolate in that manner. I think there's a book that just came out called Zucked that gets into that and sort of talks about exactly how the machine learning processes within a company like Facebook sort of hijack human emotion and understanding of events and sort of like ramp up like negative emotional context or really like strong opinions, because they know the strong opinions will get a higher emotional context and thus like people will engage with it more. And if you engage with it more, it'll get propelled further. I don't think it's nearly as hyped up as people like to think. We talk about like cars driving themselves and stuff, and you either talk to people outside the industry versus people inside the industry and you get different opinions. It all kind of comes back to where, what we see and what we hear. But as far as like creative development, I mean, tools like John's and I's, it puts a box around what needs to be created. It gives better guidelines for what needs to be created. But within those constraints, you can definitely still have creativity. I think that's actually where more creativity comes from, is like putting these constraints on what you can and can't do. And so it's like, okay, well, if I can't do that and I can't do that, what about this idea, right? And so now you start to see new ideas come out because you can't necessarily do the old tried and true trick that you used to use. It's actually a classic, if you're trying to get a team to innovate and you're talking to them as like a consultant, like a classic thing would be like, okay, well, tell me, what are some trends that you've seen? All right, we're going to make like a micro hotel. What would you do to like make it special, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody's like, oh, we'll put a dog park in it, artisanal water. And they'll go down like the list of things that you kind of expect them to think. Like, okay, you can't do those things. Now what? And so you like start crossing things off the list.
Right.
And because of those constraints, people are forced to, all right, well, what's something different that like we haven't thought of yet?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I love your point about there's never going to be a lack of demand for content. And if we're making it easier to put out more content, now we're making it easier to be more creative with content. I think those are all inherently good things.
So where do you see this field, or if you want to take it that broad, your company's evolving? What's needed most and what's next?
Yeah, so the overall field, I do think that for formulaic content, that AI will continue to progress and generate content there. So email subject lines and very standardized articles like the summarization of a earnings call, the summarization of a ball game. And we've already seen that happening for years. And so I think that'll continue to evolve. Where we see our field, our solution and the problem we're trying to solve in the review and the optimization of content eventually progressing, is that all creative teams will have a sort of tool like this, and it'll be like inviting another member of the marketing team into the creative process, and that you will give that perspective, that analysis, that insight, the same sort of weight you would give any other person on the team. And it's viewed as a solution that augments the creative process, that makes it better, that makes it scale, that standardizes it, that provides a more data-driven set of insights. And that will be a trend that I think all information workers will see, is that there will be tools that you view as other members of the team, not just a tool.
Yeah.
And I don't see why that can't happen in multiple areas, whether they're creative or more analytical, functional areas in the business.
Mm-hmm. Beyond just creating content, I know that is an issue for marketing teams and your customers as well, but is there other issues that you're seeing out there that, down the road that maybe they don't know they have yet, and you're starting to see them and maybe putting together some solutions for them?
Well, I think it goes back to how Andrew kicked off the call, in that you have to view content in the broadest possible definition. So content are the words that are coming out of your contact center and other frontline employees' mouths. Content is the conversation that your sales team is having with prospects and customers. Content is everything. So I think, as Andrew mentioned, I started off my career at Coca-Cola, and at the time the CMO was Sergio Zeman, and he loved to say that everything communicates. And that is so true. And it was everything from the way that the fountain machines looked and how they sounded, and to, of course, the ad spots on the Super Bowl commercial. And so I think taking that broadest definition of content, those are the sort of problems that we're really interested in, mm-hmm. is going beyond text and images and video to the conversations that your company is having and everything else your company is doing to communicate to that market. Mm.
Yeah. So brand consistency, I was thinking about some clients that we have who... where they try to put a message out there, but the salespeople each interpret it differently in their presentations.
Yeah.
So sort of the PowerPoint evaluation of whether things are on brand or not. It's one extension of that. I think a lot about, you immediately trigger the word personas. And that's been a big buzzword trend, et cetera. And you seem to be, impacting that significantly. Where do you see that going?
Yeah, and this is kind of what drew me to Sorter. My co-founder pitched it. He pitched it at a startup weekend, mm-hmm. here in Atlanta this past May. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, being able to understand, how to communicate with someone better. And I was thinking about back to like persona-based project work that I had done. And we had your classic like personas that you could line up for a customer, and we knew what channels we were going to go through and sort of like the talking points we were going to do, and had some touchy feely like here's how we're going to make them feel, think, and the desired behaviors. But when it came time to go write content, when it actually came time to build an email campaign, I still felt like I was making an educated guess. About what I was doing. Like there was still just like this lack of confidence in the persona and how I was delivering on that. And so this idea that we can understand the psychology of the individual who we're reaching out to on a deeper level. So, you've got your soccer mom Sally who's at the game. Well, what pieces of your value proposition are really going to resonate with that individual? You've got like the value props that are just going to solve their need, but is it actually like the factoid sheet of like, here's why we're better than competitor XYZ, we do this, we do that? Is it, this is exactly how it works, so this person feels comfortable with the process and using whatever it is that you have? Is it about the people? We always talk about like making the marketer the hero, right? Well, that might not resonate with a more skeptical individual, but it might resonate with someone who's more people oriented and likes to think about his perception among his peers or her peers within an organization. Or is it, you know, the big picture? You know, your Simon Sinek start with why, right? That doesn't resonate with everyone, but it resonates with some people and it resonates really well. So talk about your mission, or talk about your mission and talk about the people that it affects within your team. You know, these kind of things don't necessarily have to be blanket statements. There could be things that we can methodically target to individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're really taking that idea of persona, putting facts, living, breathing facts behind it, and then helping people better deliver on those personas so that
not to be too cheeky, but we're selling confidence to marketers that they're actually communicating the way that they need to.
So as we wrap up, if there was one thing you could leave our marketers who are listening with, what would you want them to think or do differently in this field?
Yeah, I think how I'd wrap up is be open-minded and embrace this notion that you can apply data and you can be methodical and disciplined in creative areas that were previously considered just pure art. And look for the technologies and embrace the technologies and new ways of thinking about the overall creative process, and the results can be staggering.
Yeah. Say, first thing I want them to do is call John to talk about Inspector Six.
He's a better salesperson.
Yeah, and then shorter.com, inspector6.com.
Yeah. That's right.
The second thing I would say is understand what this AI is, right? I think a lot of marketers just kind of glaze over it and they're like, oh, it's automation, oh, it's this, oh, it's that. And they don't take the time to actually learn what these systems are and what they're doing. You know, we spend all of our time doing this marketing via social networks. Social networks are driven by algorithms. Do you know how algorithms work? Do you know how these things operate? Because once you know that, you know, it's A, kind of scary as to how a behavioral optimization engine works. And you know, B, it's given us a little bit more mission behind what we do. You know, we look at systems like Facebook that are designed for behavior optimization, you know, get you to click on the ads, yes, but also keep you on the page. And it hasn't necessarily been to the benefit of an individual. So when we look at it, it's like, why don't we fuel those systems with a level of emotional intelligence, a level of understanding of what's subconsciously pleasant for that individual, as opposed to just going to drive a particular behavior. Yes, if you want to optimize for behavior, there's a tool or a system out there that will probably help you do that. But if you want to drive a better customer experience, not just conversions, but like lifetime value, start with a better understanding of the customer, because you know, I think we've gotten a little carried away with like the toys and tools that we have. Mm-hmm. And so before we get carried away with the toys and tools, let's stop, take a look back and be like, what's best for the customer experience? Yeah. You know, we were talking about like designing the brand experience beyond just your marketing funnel. You know, every piece of how someone interacts with your brand is what your brand is going to be perceived and known as. Mm-hmm. So
great. Well, John and Will, thank you so much for joining us. I would encourage our audience to check out Inspector 6, www.inspector6.com, and Sorter, www.sorter.com. So thank you for joining us. It's really fascinating stuff, and having used elements of what you're doing and finding it extremely enlightening and helpful, I'm excited about the possibilities for us, for our clients, and for our listeners. And I want to thank our listeners for spending time with us today, and we hope that you'll join us for our next episode of Creative Influences Content Conversations. Until then, thanks.
Thank you.